Young Turks, Hannah Cranston here with Nando Vila from Fusion. You may recognize him from his work with Fusion, also the TYT Fusion show. You were on that.
Yeah.
Also, he's on my show every single week, Think Tank. So you may recognize him then. And obviously, Brett Ehrlich joins us for this amazing second hour on a Friday night. Drop it. Oh man, I've always wanted to do that. That felt really,
really
good. And now I'm ready for a pretty crazy hour. Let's jump into the first insane story. BuzzFeed News has released an explosive expose revealing some of the roots behind Breitbart. Now they've included emails, documents, videos showing that the site has roots in neo-Nazism, white supremacy, and the alt-right. Now, if you have read this expose, there is a ton to unpack. I implore you all to read it very thoroughly. But today we're just gonna break down a few of the main takeaways from this entire article. The first being that Breitbart actively courted and solicited opinions from neo-Nazis and white supremacist leaders for their work and their articles, specifically for one article that was titled "An Establishment Conservative's Guide to the Alt-Right." Now, this piece co-written by Alum Bakari and Milo Yiannopoulos starts off, some, mostly establishment types, insist it's little more than a vehicle for the worst dregs of human society, talking about the alt-right, anti-Semites, white supremacists, and other members of the Stormfront set. They're wrong. But BuzzFeed showed us that Milo, prior to writing the article, reached out to the system administrator for the neo-Nazi website, The Daily Stormer, Andrew Weave Onerheimer, editor of the white nationalist magazine American Renaissance, Devin Saucier, and neo-reactionary Curtis Yarvin to solicit ideas. So the BuzzFeed article shows this email thread of Milo saying, "Hey, I'm writing this article on the alt-right. I'm sure you're gonna wanna have a say in it," to all of these like neo-Nazis and white supremacists. So that was one main takeaway. Were you guys surprised by that?
No.
Yeah. I don't think, I mean, the things in this article are like bombastic, but like not surprising.
Well, I think the important thing is that guys like Milo and, you know, Gavin McGinnis and these guys that are, you know, that we would consider like basically guys on the alt-right, they make the distinction. They've always said that they're not alt-right, that they're alt-light, and that we don't associate with those crazy Nazi, you know, racists that are on like the sort of hard right.
Yeah.
But this article clearly shows that they not only associate with them, but they actively solicit their advice on stories and are basically just using their own platform to try to make their hard right, like white supremacist views, a little bit more palatable for your kind of typical conservative.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all the stuff you can do technologically also. Like they're doing everything in their power to galvanize, build an audience. And so you can do that. Ways you can do that is to call the audience you want and ask them what they want. I'm sure they're also looking at the different permutations of headline strategy and a story selection and see what gets the most clicks from the same people over and over again.
Yeah.
The people that come back the most, and you can absolutely, you know, tailor your strategy in accordance with what you learn.
Yeah, no, and I agree with you. Like there, a lot of it that is revealed in this article goes into their strategy. And back to what Nando said, it's like a lot of it is rebranding, right? They're trying to rebrand like neo-Nazism, white supremacy. And oftentimes you can see through these email threads that they had to like call each other out, being like, "Ooh, that's a little off-brown. That's a little too transparent for the ideals that we're trying to perpetuate." Like when Milo had to be told not to host racists on his podcast. So he wanted to have a neo-Nazi hacker, Weave Arnheimer, on his podcast. He said, "Great provocative guest. He's one of the funniest, smartest, and most interesting people I know. Very on brand for me." And then he got a response saying, hey, gotta think about it. He's a legit racist. This is a major strategic decision for this company. And as of now, I'm leaning against it. Now, when we're talking about legit racist, you would be surprised that you can find out who's a legit racist by looking at their passwords. Now, Milo used legit racist passwords and that had blatantly anti-Semitic intonations to them. Like an April 6th email, you can see that Alam Bakari mentioned having had access to an account of Yiannopoulos's with a password that began with the word crystal, obviously an allusion to Kristallnacht from the 1938 riot against German Jews. Another email thread from June 2016 to an assistant Yiannopoulos shared the password to his email, which began Long Knives 1290, the night of the long knives, obviously. And 1290 is the year that King Edward I expelled the Jews from England. So
it's good. It's all very good.
Because until
it's all very good.
Until now,
password 123 was taken. So you wanted to get a little creative.
They had hidden behind such simple strategies as like, well, we're not racist. We have a Muslim writer.
Yes.
We're not anti-Muslim.
Milo's Jewish.
Milo is of Jewish descent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I was on a panel with Joel Pollack, who's one of the main writers for Breitbart. Oh, we were both on that same panel.
Yeah. Thanks for remembering.
I called it out. Yeah. So when people called him out for sort of the just bigotry that Breitbart spews, his sort of like reflex response was, well, like, I'm a Jew.
He was wearing a yarmulke on the panel.
We have Jew writers, and it's like, okay, like, cool. Just because you're Jew doesn't make you not a racist.
I mean, to be clear,
you know what I mean?
This dude Weave that Milo wanted to have on his podcast works for the Daily Stormer, which is like the neo-Nazi site.
Right,
like,
right.
The Struma was the name of the periodical in Nazi Germany, The Storm.
Yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, and the guy, the editor-in-chief of Breitbart, this guy Alex Marlow, comes off as like this like sad, pathetic dude in the piece where he's just like kind of overwhelmed by all these like, you know, crazy requests to have like, you know, explicitly anti-Semitic articles. He's like, whoa, we can't do that. That's like explicitly anti-Semitic.
Well,
like
he's like,
I cannot okay like
gas chamber. He's
tweets.
Like, no gas chamber jokes. We can have some like Nazi jokes, but no gas chamber jokes. So they drew the line there.
Yeah.
Speaking of Nazis, there's been some karaoke footage Milo that has been released that I'd like to show you guys, because in it you can see that some of the onlookers include Richard Spencer and some other Milo
friend of the
fans.
Show.
Friend of the show, Dick Spence. Yeah.
Take a look at this footage of Milo singing America the Beautiful. So you can see that the onlookers are giving the Nazi salute. Mm. Now, Milo says that he added that he has severe myopia, so severe nearsightedness. So it was impossible for him to see the Hitler salute from feet away. Unfortunately for Milo, a video is worth 1,000 words. Take a look at this next part of the video. Yeah.
Oh my God.
So we're laughing at this because it is so ridiculous and so absurd in the ways that they have tried to rebrand the alt. I mean, rebrand Nazism, rebrand white supremacy, rebrand like the KKK to be like cool and alternative or whatever. We're laughing because it's so ridiculous
like
and
alt-rock.
So transparent. Yeah, essentially. But it's not funny because they basically, you know, got moved like a large portion of our country. And brainwash them into believing some of the things that they believe now, just sort of behind this cool terminology.
Well, not just that, but I think that the really interesting thing in the article, I mean, okay, shocker, Milo's a disgusting racist, right? Mm. But the real interesting thing that I thought in the article was that like there was many sort of people who were secretly fans of Breitbart and feeding them kind of story ideas that were in mainstream outlets or in sort of, or in even liberal outlets, you know, like there was a—
Let's get into that, like, cause I have a graphic for that. I agree with you. That was like the sort of the biggest mind fuck of all of this, right? Because there's a lot of these like quote unquote liberals working for liberal outlets that basically gave Milo tips, including Mitchell Sunderland, who's a senior staff writer for Vice's Women's Channel broadly, who asked Yiannopoulos to mock New York Times columnist Lindy West, whom he called a fat feminist. David Auerbach, who is a former tech reporter for Slate, he passed along background information about the love life of Anita Sarkeesian during the Gamergate target. And there was a whole host of people and writers and people who work in Hollywood who were basically passing along information, people within Google, people at Hollywood, people who worked for E, who passed along this information of seemingly things that were too PC within their organizations and then had Milo write about
them. That's the thing, and it's an important distinction. Just because journalists have a line of communication with terrible people does not make them terrorists. They're terrible. Like, I mean, a lot of the best journalism ever done is journalists sitting down with whack jobs and shitbirds.
Right.
But
this is not what was happening.
Yeah.
This is them saying like, you should write about this, Milo, like me. And I think both sections of this bleed together in this dynamic of what some might call locker room talk, but others might look at and say like, this is severe, terrible, acidic racism of people like Milo who are in his karaoke performance with other people who don't know, they think they're comedians, they think they're funny, that they don't know how to get people to like them or laugh at them. They just think, to give them the ultimate benefit of the doubt, they think by saying the universally worst seeming thing that they get a pass because it's a joke. Mm-hmm. And mix that with people who aren't doing that. People who are genuinely terrible racists. And you get another level to the echo chamber of people reinforcing. And you read it, there's writing about it. A lot of folks don't know the difference. And then there's just twice as many bastards out there that are working together.
Yeah, there's definitely like the jokey aspect of it, right? And so that's Milo's claim when he writes, you know, these things about birth control and feminism is a cancer. He says that he's just trying to be inflammatory and get a response. But then when you look at some of the emails, especially between him and Bannon sort of like threatening him, putting him in his place, saying that he needs to, you know, really stir up drama. All of his emails end in hashtag war. There's evidence that
Can we talk about Bannon's email style? I mean, he emails like a 13-year-old girl on AIM.
AIM reference.
Yeah, I mean that's like the that was like one of the more shocking revelations of this thing.
Yeah, he does use the U instead of Y-O.
Yeah,
you know.
And R.
Instead
of R.
Yes, but I mean that's the thing is despite that, he does keep up communication with Milo when he goes into the White House. Milo talks about evidence that Trump used some of Milo's quotes and some of the things that he has said before in speeches. So there's a clear direct line of communication there, which should terrify us all. I mean, I think like we can laugh at some of these things and we can be like, oh my God, this is so ridiculous. But these are people who truly and firmly believe this and want to change the country. And they commend each other on talking about European roots and getting back to our Western civilization. And we need somebody on the Western war front and all of this crazy, ludicrous things. And it's serious, and they're serious. They want this war, and they want to make this country like completely white.
Well, the other thing that we haven't talked about yet is that this whole thing, that behind this whole thing, is the Mercer family, like a family of billionaires that is funding this whole operation. And the way Bannon treats them, and the way Milo treats them, it's just like as if they were these like kind of like literal
gods,
overlords.
Yeah.
That were. I mean, the whole thing is just. I mean, it almost like fits too perfectly in what we had always suspected was going on. You know, that there was this sort of explicitly racist movement coming up in the United States that was also explicitly funded by, you know, our billionaire class. So, I mean, it just kind of like takes off the hood, no pun intended, off the whole thing.
Pun intended.
All right. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't get the singing America the Beautiful and then doing Nazi salutes. We fought against them. They were our enemies in World War II.
And we're fighting against them now.
It's just so, I don't know. My take on Milo is he's so pathetic.
It's so sad. Yeah. It's so transparent. It's so sad.
Pathetic, like he has probably some severe daddy issues. Yeah. Bannon is the replacement for his father.
Yeah.
Like that's, and there's no excuse because you can go to a psychiatrist, but and like talk to someone, but you can't. I mean, I guess you can do whatever you want with this America Jack, but still, like, it is so sad how he is so desperately in search of an audience. He wants everyone to like him. He wants everyone to think he's smarter than he actually is.
Well, because he didn't write any of his pieces. Well, and that's another amazing revelation. He couldn't even write his own pieces.
He ghostwrote a lot. I mean, obviously, other people ghostwrote a lot of his pieces. But I think what you're getting into is really, really interesting because it is a lot of it just for attention. You can see that in the email threads. There was one where Bannon basically like slapped him on the wrist for something. He's like, I'm so sorry. I'll do better next week. I'll attack the Muslims.
It's so good.
Like, he's like, next week I'll do a week of Islam. And it's like, whoa, like these people's heads, like they're just trying to incite this hatred.
So what happens next? What's the next step? This story came out blockbuster.
I mean, here's the thing is like this story comes out and liberals like ourselves are upset and going crazy. And we saw it everywhere on Twitter last night. But I don't think anybody who reads Breitbart, I mean, Breitbart put out an article, you know, in response to it saying that it was like bullshit. And people who are going to read that and they're going to think that's the truth. And that's the problem with our country right now is because people believe the news that they're getting from their sources and that's it. And they're not going to question it.
Well, I think that there's an element that, you know, before last year, I remember like, you know, kind of, there was a big profile of the New York Times Magazine about Breitbart and the alt-right. Mm-hmm. And it was like, you know, fresh new voices on the right, you know,
it's
like.
Mostly the headlines that are terrible. And then when you read the story, it's not so bad.
Yeah, and then there's like a profile of Richard Spencer who's like the dapper Richard Spencer. He's so dapper. And like, you know, my colleague from Splinter, Libby Watson, pointed out that, for example, like Mitchell Sunderland, the Broadly editor who was, you know, telling Milo to please mock this fat feminist, wasn't exactly secretive about his friendship with Milo. But it's the kind of thing that back then it was kind of treated like as like, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
You know, he could be an editor at a women's magazine, which is so strange now to think about, like looking back. But, you know, because back then it wasn't treated as kind of this like serious thing, which it actually is, where these people are like, basically adjacent, if not kind of secretly channeling literal Nazis. Mm-hmm. You know, like I think that, like, hopefully from now on, like our sort of mainstream press won't treat them with kind of like this idea that they're just kind of like, you know, they're a little rambunctious, but they're providing fresh perspectives on like staid conservatism or whatever, you know.
And
like,
as awful and horrendous as Charlottesville was, and the effects of Charlottesville, I think it did have, the silver lining is that it sort of debunked some of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
All right, guys, we're going to take a quick break and then we're going to come back to all of the awful things that the Trump administration is doing right now. See you guys soon. All right, back on the Young Turks, Hannah, Nando, and Brett here. For the remainder of the hour, we have some awesome stories for you.
This is so awesome.
Well, the first one's not awesome.
It's my favorite.
The second one's not awesome, but the last one's great. So stick around. Now we have some bad news. Today, the Trump administration rolled back the Obama-era birth control mandate, and it's effective immediately. Now, they rescinded it essentially. Yeah. The federal requirement for employers to include birth control coverage in their health insurance plans, vastly expanding exemptions for those that cite moral or religious objections. Now, currently, more than 55 million women have access to birth control without co-payments because of the contraceptive coverage mandate. Now, this saves them $1.4 billion a year, okay, for all of these 55 million women, okay? Now, under the new regulations, hundreds of thousands of women could lose birth control benefits they now receive at no cost under the Affordable Care Act. Now, the administration has listed health risks that it says may be associated with the use of certain contraceptives. And it says the mandate could promote risky sexual behavior among some teenagers and young adults. Unfortunately, there has been no study that has proven that taking away contraception takes away people from having sex. Like, that's just not how it works. Teens are gonna have sex, people are gonna have sex, and removing contraception from the equation is not gonna stop them from doing that. Now, the mandate also, the administration says, imposes a substantial burden on the free exercise of religion by certain employers who object to it. It also imposes a substantial burden on all of the women who now have to pay for birth control.
Yeah, this is a vag tax.
Yeah.
It's a tax for having a vagina. Mm. It costs you more money to be a woman now.
Yeah, mm-hmm. 1.7 billion,
whatever it was. A responsible woman, yeah. A woman who for whatever reason wants to take birth control, because sometimes that is for birth control, but other times they're reproductive, or there's
hormonal
balancing issues that the birth control is prescribed to help.
Yeah, so obviously there's a whole host of reasons of why people use birth control, right? It can be for contraception, obviously, which is the main reason, but there's acne, PCOS, like so many other reasons that people use birth control, but it doesn't really matter, right? Because the thing is it's about having the choice over your own body. And I have gotten a bunch of responses on my Twitter today when I tweeted out like my body, my choice, and people were like, sure, but why should I have to pay for your birth control? And it's like, so when you break it down into the economics and you talk about the economics of birth control, for every $1 that we spend on providing contraception, you save $4, all right, when it comes to education, public health, water and sanitation. So there's actually a huge economic advantage to providing free contraception, if that's your main concern, besides the whole, like, I don't know, having a, you know, decision over my own body, over my own person.
Not just that, but that's how like insurance works. Yeah. I don't know, like, you know, like I remember when the Obamacare repeal debate was going on, like conservatives would say, like, why should I have to pay for like a woman's breast cancer or whatever? It's like, because that's how insurance works.
Yeah.
Like, that's just, that's fun.
Well, I mean, we're paying for your Viagra. Well,
not just that, but like, if you don't believe that, then you don't believe in the concept of insurance, in which case, then no one in the world, like, no one in America would be able to afford any healthcare treatment.
It's everyone pays into a pool of money that the insurance company runs, and the amount that they have to pay is determined by the general risk pool of the entire world and, you know, adjusted person to person. And then when money needs to get paid out to someone for a problem, that comes from the money that everybody's paying in. So yes, you are paying for everyone's problems.
Yeah.
And I just thought, like, I mean, you know, like, I object to many things, you know, that, I mean, my tax dollars go to administer the death penalty, you know, in Florida when I used to live there.
Flying people on private jets.
Flying people on private jet or droning people across the world. Like, I don't, you know, I don't, I am morally objecting to those things, but like, I'm not gonna, like, you know, stop paying my taxes.
Right.
Well, I mean, that argument, it's kind of like, well, then you should find a way to get the political climate to change in a way that allows you to have the, you know, intended consequence happen. And that's what they have. They have done that. So they've gone through this system. It feels like the system's messed up. It is a woman, it's a tax on being a woman.
Yeah. Right, I mean, that's what it is. And so when they talk about some of the reasons that they did this, it's for these religious for-profit institutions and organizations, whether they be small businesses or large businesses, colleges and universities, who feel morally culpable for, you know, providing contraception or you know, premarital sex and things like that. And then, so they're gonna take away contraception coverage, and then they're gonna take away your right to have an abortion, right? With the bill that they just passed this week for 20-week abortions. And it's like, you're hitting us from all angles. Like, we're not gonna give you contraception, but we're also not gonna allow you to have an abortion. And it's like, I feel like, and I woke up and when I read this news story this morning and I got the alert on my phone, I was like, this feels like The Handmaid's Tale. It feels like a slippery slope where they're slowly taking away, not slowly, frankly, this is happening. I mean, when you think about, he just entered the presidency in January, they're taking away our rights. I mean, this is a human right to have a decision over your body, and they are taking it away. And it's just, it's frightening and it's infuriating. And I don't know what the answer is. I mean, this is effective immediately. Well, and so now employers can say tomorrow or tonight that, you know what?
How's TYT doing?
Here's what you have to pay. TYT is different, but I mean, it's $1,200 a year. And so it's gonna have a disproportionate effect on low income women. And then it's just gonna contribute to the cycle of poverty and the cycle of lack of education. And it's bullshit.
It costs more. It's gonna end up costing more.
Yeah, you're gonna pay more in taxes.
And then a lot of it doesn't make any sense. You know, it encourages dangerous behavior. Like, cite some studies. Give me something that backs that up. The dangerous behavior is more that the initiatives like this are religiously motivated, right? Mm-hmm. So they say. And another religious, something that goes hand in hand with that is abstinence-only education and lack of any sex education whatsoever.
Right.
The repress, don't talk about it. By the way, your daughter's pregnant again. And they go hand in hand, and it's just not based in reality, and that's what's so frustrating.
I mean, because when you do look at the science when it comes to contraception, the way to avoid risky sexual behavior is have comprehensive sex education and teach kids and teens and adults how to use contraceptive appropriately and give that out. I mean, communities that have contraception gives out contraception, but also has comprehensive sex education. People wait longer to have sex. They engage less in risky sexual behaviors. So it's like the science is there, the facts are there. They're just going to the opposite and just claiming.
It's just so
something
disingenuous.
That's not factual.
It's insult to injury. Mm-hmm. It's the risky sexual behavior. No, it doesn't. There's health risks involved. You don't care.
Yeah. I just can't believe that this is like a big issue for even like the majority, like even half of Republican. I mean, this is like a small, tiny minority who is just like highly organized and like highly fanatical. Like, I mean, unless the meme is true that Republicans don't fuck, which, you know, the jury's still out there.
Yeah, I think there's a few scandals that prove that wrong.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to some other bullshit news.
Hannah, I like it today.
Damn, girl.
Earlier this week, the House passed a bill that would ban 20-week abortions on the premise that unborn fetuses can feel pain. Now, unfortunately for them, thousands of studies and doctors have come out to say that this is not rooted in any science or facts. Now, earlier this week, Representative Trent Franks, who introduced the bill called Pain Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, tweeted out this thing saying, it's science, unborn babies feel pain by at least 20 weeks. Late dismemberment abortions are too extreme for America. I like how he used the foot of like a 3-year-old in that picture. Can you go back? I mean, that is like such a giant
foot. That's my foot.
So misleading.
That's my foot.
Yeah.
But then Daniel Grossman, who's a doctor, who's a practicing physician, public health researcher, and a professor of OBGYN and reproductive services at the University of California, San Francisco, responded to his tweet and it went viral. So let's get into it. He goes, "Hi, Representative Trent Franks. I'm a researcher and abortion provider. This isn't actually science. I'd be happy to educate you about it if you'd like." So he did. First, you should know that late term abortion is not a medical term at all. Anti-abortion advocates made it up. That's very interesting. And because of restrictions on access, patients have a hard time getting a first trimester abortion. Now, he also tweeted out a very informative fact sheet of why patients might get an abortion at 20 weeks or right after. And so, said 80% of women seeking later abortion have at least one of five characteristics: women raising children alone, women with a history of substance abuse, heavy drinking, and or depression. That's the second most common reason. Women who experienced recent conflict or violence with their partner. Women who had trouble deciding what to do about the pregnancy, followed by trouble accessing services. And women under the age of 20 who had never given birth. So first of all, any sort of abortion after 20 weeks only account for 1.4% of abortions. But the second of all, like when you look at these reasons, like it just sort of like illuminates the fact that you don't want to bring a child into these circumstances, right? If the mother is a, you know, heavy drug user or drinker and is suffering from a mental illness and decides, you know what, this is not the right home to bring a child into, or she's facing domestic abuse and she doesn't want to bring a child into that home. Why on earth would you say, nope, too bad, like sucks for you. You have to bring a child into that world, and then they're going to be brought up in that world. And when you look at children who are brought up in homes with heavy drinking or alcohol abuse or drug abuse or domestic violence, that cycle is perpetuated. Mm. That cycle is continued. And so you are not pro-life, you are continuing a cycle of really awful behavior.
Right, but their argument is like you're killing a baby. Like I'd rather get the baby in a new home. I think it's more like it's still inside her, it's her body. Get off it.
Yeah.
Stay away for whatever reason. Like now I've given room to your rhetorical approach and kind of given it merit as like, yeah, it is a baby and it is an individual and you kind of describing it as once it's already outside the body. And the thing is like, no, it's inside her, it's her body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let her make the decision. I don't care what you think. It's not your purview.
Right. And so there have been, I mean, if we're going to talk about science and facts, like there have been multiple studies that have tried to sort of figure out when the fetus might be able to feel pain. And most of these studies conclude that it's probably not until the third trimester due to the development of the fetus. And so that's also important science to include in this, right? And there's not like third trimester abortions, like that's not a thing.
But you're almost conceding too much there. I feel like you're almost playing on their turf when you're even getting into that. I think what Brett said that like at the end of the day, you know, like something that is inside a woman's body, like something that like it is part of her, it is connected to her. Like that's something that she should be able to decide what to do. You know, sort of litigating the
exact moment is she's thinking. Is exactly she's thinking and why she's making these decisions.
Right. I agree. You have like if you were against abortion because of for whatever reason, like great. Don't have one, but you don't get to decide what another woman does with her body, right? But I do when they're talking and they're bringing up science and facts, I do want to come back with the science and the facts behind what they're saying because morally and ethically, and ideologically, like I'm like no, of course not. Like you get to decide what happens to your body, what happens to your unborn fetus, of course.
Yeah.
But also, your facts are bullshit.
And all and there's a Refinery 29, I mentioned this really quickly at the end of the show. There's an article, a column that says, I carry my grief in a visible bump. Don't ban abortion for women like me. It's a woman who is pregnant and she's dealing with a child with a severe birth defect that will, you know, there's like a 99% chance that it'll be stillborn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And she's still figuring out the realities of that situation until a late time. Mm-hmm. And so she needs to have access to that medical procedure based on a very real reason. And I think to your point, for sure, like to put more personal stories in front of people so they can understand that no one's taking this decision lightly.
Well, it should. I mean, I agree with you that that's a great way to evoke like empathy and human emotion. But at the same time, it's like nobody's trying to take away rights of a man's, like a man that a man has over his own body, right? You try to take away gun rights from people and they flipping lose their shit. But like, okay, let's just take a women's rights away from their own freaking body.
Right. No gun control and no birth control while we're at it.
I mean, it's just.
What others? No parental controls on my DVR.
I don't know. I steamed my red dress and white cap yesterday, so I'm prepared.
Your red dress from Handmaid's?
Handmaid's Tale.
Under his eye. Under his eye.
All right, let's move on to the next story. After numerous accusations of sexual harassment, the Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein has issued an apology that kind of insinuates that he should get less of a backlash for some of his actions due to his liberalism. So I'm going to read you some of his apology. He says that now he's going to need a place to channel his anger, and so he's going to give the NRA his full attention. And he also talks about one year ago, he began organizing a $5 million foundation to give scholarships to women directors at USC. So that's sort of how he ends his apology for harassing women for upwards of 20 years. Multiple women have come out and said that he sexually harassed them, most notably Ashley Judd. So that's very interesting. And in fact, he has actually been an advocate for liberal causes and women's rights. In fact, he appeared at his local women's march last January. He endowed a faculty chair in Gloria Steinem's name. Malia Obama interned for him. And so I think a lot of people are reading this and hearing this information. I mean, it's included in every article about him, and thinking that it's sort of contradictory. And I think that, like, okay, you can be a woke bro and you can be progressive. Also, you can be an asshole. Like, it's very possible to be both. They're not mutually exclusive. And I think for sometimes people think that because you know, are on like the right side and because you think and believe in these truly moral causes and you give to them and you are progressive and whatever, that makes you exempt from committing pretty heinous actions. I mean, this is not a left or a right issue. This is a man in power issue.
I think this whole thing kind of shows a little bit of like the bankruptcy of like American liberalism in a lot of sense. Like that day, these stories about Harvey Weinstein, I mean, like, come on, shocker. Harvey Weinstein is a sexual predator. You know, like, they were out there, everyone kind of like, there were rumors all the time. And you know, the fact that they're just like so willing to turn the other way because, you know, they respect his money or his, you know, the cool movies that he puts out, you know, like, yeah,
he's rich and powerful.
You know, like, there was a story that David Sirota, the investigative journalist for the International Business Times, did a story yesterday. Good for him. There you go. Did a story yesterday about the, you know, how he donated $10,000 to Cy Vance, the district attorney for New York, who's like a super corrupt dude, to drop charges of sexual harassment against them. You know, like, it's just like, and this was like, all this stuff is kind of out there, and like they don't care. But they don't really care.
But even if it's not out there, I mean, when you think about some, like, we had Bill O'Reilly, we had Roger Ailes, but even some of the more like progressive and liberal companies are not exempt from this. I mean, you look at Google, you look at all the tech companies and Silicon Valley CEOs that were exposed in that New York Times like article. Like, no, sexual harassment is an issue, and it's not about the left or the right or who you donate to or if you put your pussy hat on. It is about, like, sexual harassment is ingrained into our culture, and we need to do something now and something serious to stop it.
Yeah, and I mean, Harvey Weinstein, I've worked in like Hollywood before. Like, I've had the job at the talent agency that you're supposed to have when you first start working here. And there's one book when I first started that was just called Perception, Perception, Perception or something, or it's all about perception. And that's what I think is at play when you see things like Harvey Weinstein gave money to a woman's charity. He went down to the thing. He's trying to seem woke. Or whatever that stupid word is. But you know, he's trying to seem that way because of course he is, because he wants to be thought of as an activist, because activists are good. He wants to use all of his influence and all of his money to swing his wiener around and get, you know, that thing because he can't do it with human kindness and personal connection.
I don't even know if it's like that explicit. Like, I do think that there's like a chance that this is very like a subconscious thing. I mean, this culture is ingrained into people's like psyche. And so maybe he is a true and authentic. I mean, I know
people who have had meetings with Harvey Weinstein that ended with Harvey Weinstein throwing a chair through a window.
Yeah.
Cuz he's just like a darkened room with a suitcase full of cash. And like, up yours, buddy.
But who knows? Like, maybe he believes in these causes, right? Maybe he believes and he's a real activist.
But this is where.
Like, he can do this awful thing, and so I think it's important. And the left is trying to separate from him. There have been multiple senators who are donating his campaign contributions to them to different causes. Senator Martin Heinrich of New Mexico is donating the money that Harvey Weinstein gave him to Community Against Violence, Blumenthal to a campaign to the Connecticut Alliance to End Sexual Violence, Cory Booker to the New Jersey Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and many other senators are doing this. So we're waiting to see what other senators do. They're trying to. Weinstein has taken an indefinite leave during the harassment inquiry.
Very courageous.
It's crazy, but so you know, the point of there's still people in Hollywood still going to do? Like if Miramax, or not even Miramax anymore, the Weinstein Company is gonna finance that movie. Yeah, I'm gonna do it. I need the money.
I mean, Woody Allen still makes movies, you know, like, and gets big actors to work with him. And
he's so talented.
You know, like they don't, at the end of the day, they don't really care about this stuff.
Yeah. Let's try to fit in one more story. The fearless girl statue who faces off the charging bull on Wall Street has become a symbol of feminism. Unfortunately, it turns out that it was an empty symbol of equality that was a facade for a large and pervasive gender pay gap. Now on Thursday, State Street, the $2.6 trillion investment firm that funded the fearless girl and unveiled her to great fanfare on International Women's Day in March, agreed to shell out $5 million to settlement claims that it pays its female and black executives less than white men at the firm. The back pay will go to 305 female senior executives and 15 black vice presidents who worked in a State Street office in Boston. The firm also has to submit a thorough analysis of its pay and agree to fix any other discrepancies according to a settlement agreement with regulators from the Department of Labor. Now, according to State Street, she represented the power of women in leadership and the potential of the next generation of women leaders, which is lovely, but not rooted in reality, because only 3 women sit on its 10-member board of directors, and of the 28 executive on its leadership team, 5 are women, one of whom appears to be black, and all 23 are white. Now, this isn't, State Street is not alone in this discrepancy. I mean, 5% of CEOs in the finance world are women, 29% of senior executives are women, and at the 3 largest banks, less than 3% of executives are black. So again, this is an example of somebody, a company trying to capitalize on the resist movement, on being woke, but not doing the work behind it.
Yeah, again, color me shocked, you know, that the structures of capital and, you know, the inequality that we have in America are getting wise to the idea that if they kind of throw a couple symbolic bones to some sort of progressive cause, they'll get like a short-term burst of, you know, sympathy and you know, and
credit.
Good marketing credit, you know, when reality, you know, they really are just working to perpetuate all kinds of inequalities, whether they're gender-based or, you know, race-based or whatever.
Now she's smiling for the right reason.
Right.
Now it means it.
Yeah.
Now that they're having to pay, you know, for what they did. Now that kid, the smiling girl, means something real. I mean, but what a stupid oversight, the PR behind that. Come on, guys.
Well, I mean, when you think about like Google too, like Google said like, oh, we, you know, pay everybody equally. There's no gender pay gap here. And then it comes out because they want to be progressive. They want to be doing the right thing. They just like financially don't
want to
do the right thing.
They should, get ahead of it.
They know that it's good.
It's going to come out. Get ahead of it.
Yeah.
It's going to rip the Band-Aid off.
Or like, don't even worry about the press. Just do the right thing because it's the right thing.
I think State Street's statement about the fearless girl is kind of very indicative, where it's like, you know, they celebrate, you know, female leadership and female leaders, and you know, while that's all well and good, it's such a limited vision of what like an emancipatory women's movement could be, right? I mean, it's just like, so long as like we maintain these structures of inequality and we make sure that, you know, more or less there's gender equity at the tippity top, everything should be fine. And like, that's not true, you know, like that'll just help out like a handful of women and leave millions of women sort of still impoverished and, you know, suffering the consequences of, you know, this horrible
system. Guys, that's all we have for you tonight. Have an awesome Friday and we'll see you Monday. Bye-bye.